Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to keepitfunohio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
This episode is brought to you by PwC. When unprecedented times are all the time, it's time to start walking the talk. Leaders like you turn to PwC to see and stay ahead. Upskill your workforce, use intelligent automation, and transform big ideas into breakthrough reinvention. Explore the human-led, tech-powered solutions that help you reinvent. It's all part of the new equation. Learn more at pwc.com.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Slate's Double X Gabfest is sponsored by Bowl & Branch, making luxury bedding affordable and convenient to order from home. Bowl & Branch sheets are made from organic cotton that's fair trade certified, and right now, get $50 off a set of sheets, plus free shipping, when you go to bowlandbranch.com and use the promo code XX. That's B-O-L-L and branch.com and the promo code D-O-U-B-L-E-X.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Welcome to the XX Gabfest for Thursday, July 23rd, 2015, the Manic Panic Armpits edition. I'm Noreen Malone, an editor at New York Magazine. I'm joined in the New York studios by June Thomas, the editor of Outward, Slate's LGBTQ blog. Hi, June.
Hey, Noreen. Nice speaking of all the initials there.
it's a generational thing. We are taught it at birth as a millennial generation.
Good.
And we also have special guest Seth Stevenson, a Slate contributor, who will be standing in for All the Men Everywhere this week while Hannah Rosen is out of town. Hi, Seth. Are you up to it?
Of course I'm up to it, Noreen. Hi, June.
Hello.
This is my chance.
Okay. Our three topics for today, we are going to start with a very important issue, the trend of long armpit hair on young women, not just long armpit hair, but Easter egg color dyed long armpit hair. Are you just an old fogey if you're sporting a plain old shaved pit these days? Second, we'll talk about Planned Parenthood, which is once more under attack from a right-wing activist group, this time one with thousands of hours of undercover tape shot from inside clinics. Should the pro-choice movement be worried? And third, we all know about the male gaze, but what is the female gaze circa 2015? So before we jump into our first topic, we just wanted to say that thank you to everyone who wrote in to our email inboxes about asexuality. I would say it was sort of a mix of people who were happy we'd done it and wanted to share their story, and people sort of scolding us for asking more questions than, you know, being informed.
Right. Yeah, I think you got the response exactly right. Like, there was this, finally someone's talking about this, finally my sort of feelings are being represented, but then just some disappointment that we didn't know as much as we, in their view, should have. But that also feels kind of to be expected when, as everyone says, this is just not a topic that people have really gotten out into the mainstream yet.
But I personally did learn a lot from the emails that people sent us. So thank you for those. They were heartfelt and moving.
Yeah. And people really shared. So thank you.
Yeah. All right. On to our first topic. Nobody questions when a guy wearing a tank top does a selfie that shows his armpit hair. But if I happen to show my armpit hair in a selfie, it's like, whoa, feminist witch asking for attention. So says 17-year-old Destiny Moreno in a recent New York Times style section piece about the recent trend of young women showing off long armpit hair. But in a twist, these women aren't going natural exactly. They're also dyeing it pink and blue and yellow and whatever they want. So Miley Cyrus, I would say, is the poster girl for this movement. However, this morning, just as we were heading to the studio to prepare to do this, our intrepid intern, Jesse, sent us some breaking news from Instagram, which is that Miley Cyrus has just gone to the waxer and waxed off her armpit hair. So we might have waited too long to talk about this, but...
Or we might be at the perfect moment.
Right, we might be at the perfect moment. The world is divided between women with dyed armpit hair and the rest of us. Possibly. Seth, what does it telegraph to you if a woman has dyed, let's say pink, let's pick pink armpit hair?
What does it telegraph to me? Well, judging by the YouTube video by Destiny, that young woman, she was trying to convey, and she said stuff like, these choices about grooming are not our choices. And so she was trying to convey that she's making her own choices. She's doing what she wants to do. And it's not about what other people think. And she said, and it was surprising to her that when she dyed her armpit hair, now they're, you know, guys think I'm the coolest chick in the world. So I guess, you know, based on that, I'm not sure what someone's trying to convey, but it doesn't bother me. I think it's great. I mean, I think it's wonderful. Kind of made me want to dye my armpit hair. It's like, it's funny that we have armpit hair. It's silly that we have armpit hair. And the idea of dyeing it pink, I think, is delightful. So I'm all for it.
Well, the cut did some intrepid journalism on why we do have armpit hair. Oh. One theory is that it wicks sweat away from the skin, actually. So I think a lot of people think you're going to smell more if you have pit hair. But maybe it's actually part of nature's air conditioner. Mm. Another theory, just if we want to really go in deep, is that it's to prevent chafing between the arm and the torso.
Oh.
So really, armpit hair seems like...
So women who shave are really harming the body's evolutionary sort of steps toward... preserving our cool and just our separation between arm and torso.
Now, June, I feel like you maybe came of age in another era when armpit hair was cool. Is that correct?
Well, I don't know that it was ever cool. but I think it was like there was a time when it was really important if you were a feminist to not shave your legs, not shave your armpits. And I have to also admit that it just got me into some lazy ways. It was really interesting to me to read these pieces that it seemed that everybody had to at some point say, it's not just laziness now. It's not laziness. It's a choice. And I feel like this whole move toward dying is, I mean, either it's like a sort of a step in between shaving and just going natural or being lazy, whichever way you choose to do it. Or just like not really being ready to accept that women have hairy armpits too. And having to sort of disguise it or somehow, I don't know, divert attention by, you know, turning it bright blue or something.
I'm totally with you. I think it's $65 to dye your armpits.
Like,
I'm sorry, shaving is almost free. And that's just way too much money. It's also, you don't know what toxins are
exactly.
in the armpit. And it's right near your, like, lymph
exactly.
nodes.
Exactly.
That alarms me, you know. It just seems like you're... drawing attention to how sort of hippy-dippy you are,
right.
how punk, how whatever. But the hair dye in that area just, to me, undermines it or something.
I agree. I feel like this whole thing with armpit hair in women, which I know from experience that a lot of people really do think is gross, which I don't understand. It's not gross in men, but it's gross in women. Like, it just feels like this is something that we do. I don't even think that women know that they're doing it, but I guess it's to make men feel manly. Because, like, men have armpit hair and that separates them from women. But actually, it doesn't. It's just that women have shaved theirs off to look more like children.
Right. So I think the dyeing seems like maybe an effort to swing the pendulum all the way in one direction such that undyed armpit hair now becomes, like, a normal thing. So since this is in some ways about the gaze of others, of others, I will tell one story, which is that when I was, like, 15 or 16, I was on this... sailing trip, that sounds obnoxious, but with this, and there was this female sailing counselor who's like a badass sailor and just did everything on the boat and carried a knife on her hip. And she had armpit hair. She must have been in her 30s, I think, I would guess. And she had armpit hair. And I developed a huge crush on her when I was 15 or 16. She was so hot, like, and so competent. And the armpit hair somehow was like really sexy that she didn't care. And so for me, armpit hair has never been a thing. Like, it doesn't bother me at all, actually. And I think a lot of European women don't shave their armpits, and that has never bothered me at all. What's crazy to me is that women shave their legs, which is a, like, I'm not create interesting, socially loaded for me right. is that women shave their legs. And that's like sort of a non-starter, right? You're not finding these women, like even probably Destiny Moreno isn't leaving her legs unshaved and dyeing her leg hair. That's like another, that's another step.
Wait, right? Why is that more crazy to you than armpit hair?
Okay, here's what I mean. Armpit hair does not bother me, but somehow I have been socially conditioned. I recognize that it's social conditioning, that leg hair is a thing for me. And
I mean, it's not attractive.
It's not super attractive uh-huh. when if I see a woman with uh-huh. like grown out curly leg hair. Right. And that is social conditioning, obviously. And I'm not sure why I draw the line after armpit hair, but before leg hair. But that's what society has done to me, June.
No, it's because pheromones are secreted in the armpit hair and they're not in the leg hair.
Is that what's
well,
that
the difference? That's one whole theory of like armpit hair is that, you know, you become like humans or animals and you become more attracted to someone once you like have more, you know, that whole theory.
Right. Well, so isn't the next step that Miley Cyrus grows out her leg hair and like and really maybe curly she, and...
I think that would be so unlikely to happen. Like, I mean, I think it... It's funny because I don't shave my legs, and that really is about being lazy. However, if I'm going to expose them, I do. Not because I want to, or because anybody who is in my close intimate circle cares or would actually have any feelings whatsoever about it, but because people do look at you weird, and it makes you self-conscious, and it's clear that people think it's ugly. And so you're like, you're opening yourself. If you choose to do not to do what you're supposed to do, you're opening yourself up to sort of negative looks and negative responses. And so why would you do that even if you don't really want to shave? Like, you should just to avoid aggravation. But I really don't see these, you know, because there was this parade of famous armpit sporters.
Mm-hmm. It's very, very
enormous.
Trendy right now. Very
like
trendy
Madonna,
right now.
Jemima Kirk, apparently Julia Roberts did it once in an old movie.
Well, but Julia Roberts got in trouble. This is what's interesting to me. I remember I must have been in college or around then, and it was like a big tabloid moment. Julia Roberts had been caught on the red carpet with unshaved pits, and everyone was like, so gross. Like, I can't believe she walked out of the house doing that. And now it's celebrated. Like, Jemima Kirk was on the red carpet doing it, and everyone was like, that's so sexy, which right. I think it was.
Although I did one of the stories we were looking at, the story, I think it was from E, was a little snarky about Jemima Kirk.
Well,
and it was like, what yeah. a beautiful ensemble. And she has a flower in her hair. But ew, look at those armpits. That really distracts us from the fashion. And it was kind of like enforcing these norms on her.
I think it depends what corner of the internet you look in.
Right. You know, what's interesting to me, too, is that we still, some magazines or some newspapers didn't say anything or were sort of positive about it. Like, I was kind of surprised. I think it was the Daily News, one of the New York tabloids we were looking at, was a tiny bit snarky, but basically was supportive. But magazines and newspapers have stopped making negative comments about tattoos. Like, most of the people we've just mentioned, not I don't think Julia Roberts or Madonna, have a lot of tattoos. Jemima Kirk certainly does in all over her body, some of which look like she did them herself, you know, when she was a teenager. And I think a few years ago, people would have been like, oh my God, look at those tattoos. And now we've completely changed our attitude to that. So I wonder if maybe we are truly in a transitional moment, because tattoos now don't even raise a comment.
I'm just not sure they're analogous. I see what you're saying, but I think there's something about female body hair that will always be just a little more, like you were saying, policed, you know?
Yeah.
The pendulum has swung away from the sort of like bikini wax era where everyone wanted to be like a hairless mole rat.
Right.
But I don't think it's ever going to be completely like, you know, women walking around with unshaved legs.
Yeah.
And in part, I will defend the practice of leg shaving. In part, it's like you feel good, like you touch your own legs and
right.
it feels good.
Should
right.
I try it?
I was a swimmer in high school and we didn't shave our legs the whole winter, which was interesting. But then you like shave it. And the dudes, too, shaved all their legs for your big meat. You had to like shave off all of your body hair. And the dudes were really into it. They like kind of wanted to keep doing it. So maybe you should on your next big athletic event, shave off all your body hair and just go for it.
Sold.
Well, I mean, let's not act too. I mean, this is the Double X Gab Fest, and I think it's certainly much more policed among women, like on a level that's not even comparable to men. However, there are certain parts of the male anatomy that are considered unattractive when they're hairy, like the back. You know, back hair, which you see even guys on, you know, we're going to be talking a little bit later about Magic Mike, or it might come up in conversation, where they don't have any body hair on any of them, except maybe a little bit on their face to show that they're dudes. But you often see in the media, you know, even guys who've got a little bit of chest hair. You know, they've been allowed a little bit of stubble. They magically have no hair whatsoever on their backs.
I think that's more a media thing and less in real life. Like,
really?
I think dudes in real life don't feel that bad about their back hair.
Yeah.
I think they're fine to let it go.
The next stage for men is to dye their nose hair or their ear hair.
So I guess, have a question. I don't spend much time in locker rooms or date widely. But I guess I'm wondering, have we now developed a stage where the armpit hair is having a moment, but the rest of the body is severely depilated? I mean, is that the only hair on the body? Are women keeping their armpit hair so that they can just show, no, really, I have gone through puberty because there's no other hair on their body? Seth, I'm looking at you, I guess.
I offer a personal observation, which is when I was last dating in the early 90s, there was, you know, pubic trimming hair was, you know, not really a thing. And then when I started dating again in like 2011, suddenly there was a lot more attention paid to getting rid of pubic hair. And it was like a sea change. And I don't know, you know, maybe the pendulum is swung back on that now. And maybe, you know, I think that sort of goes back and forth, or at least it has post 2000 maybe gone back and forth a little. But that is like the unspoken. I mean, that's another huge decision. Are you doing it for you? Are you doing it for other people? It's not visible in public usually. So it's just a little different. But I don't, you know, Noreen, what do you talk to your friends about this? What do people say?
I think that's like a very personal preference. I did talk to a waxer in Brooklyn about this not so long ago, like what the trend was. And she felt, however, this is full disclosure, Cobble Hill, not where the cool girls live. She felt that that it had gone away from the full bikini wax that, you know, so many people were enthralled to after the Sex and the City era, sort of in the era of Lindsay Lohan lifting up her skirt, and that it had gone to a more like conservative wax from most women. But yeah, I think it's like a very personal decision, but one that most women do pay attention to. And I would guess that, I mean, maybe the women who are dyeing their armpit hair are, I don't want to speculate on what they're doing, but who knows?
But it's a possibility.
It's a possibility. Leave it
to that. It's funny how something that used to be for porn stars becomes pretty mainstream. I don't know if that has to do with the rise of like easily accessible porn, but that was once something that was associated with porn stars, and now it's just, hey, anybody might do that.
Yeah, let's blame men for that.
I will take it.
So I have one last question on armpit hair. Is this something you have to just be young and super attractive to pull off? Is that why we all like it? Because it's on Jemima Kirk and Miley Cyrus and they look great. But if it were on 68-year-old battle axe, we might be like, ew.
First of all, I resent your use of that term, Noreen.
But I aspire to be a 68-year-old battle axe, for the record.
One thing about armpit hair, it is sort of contained, right? It's a small it's a small patch that can only be so big. And so it's sort of contained. And so the shock that you are imagining, Noreen, I think it's like it's limited in scope, right? It's like it's not the same thing as the long, hairy leg with curls like just all the way up. It's not quite the same amount of real estate.
Yeah.
All right. Well, this is just going to be Body Hair Weekly. We've really elevated the conversation. So let's move on to our second topic. But first, I think we have a sponsor.
We certainly do. Now, I don't know about you guys, but I spend even more than a third of my life in bed. And when I'm in bed, all I can think about are my
sheets. More than a third? Wait, let's do
that. Yeah, I really do, because I like to get a lot of sleep.
And okay, that's 8 out.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I like to get a lot of sleep, and I enjoy just like sitting around in bed, reading in bed, all of that stuff.
Or you're like Churchill. He would just do his work in bed all morning.
Yeah. You know, I typically don't, but I've often thought like it's coming. You know, that's going to be my third age. My golden age will be spent largely in bed, but in a happy way. So when you're in bed, one of the key factors is the sheets, and I'm not sure that we really pay enough attention to them. And we have so many myths about our sheets, thread count, total marketing myth, Egyptian cotton buzzword, nothing to do with Egypt, just the name of a plant that's grown in places like Pakistan and China. So like a lot of businesses that are being disrupted by the internet, sheets are also part of that trend. And the company Boll & Branch has made luxury bedding affordable. Typically, when you buy bedding, you're paying an 800% markup at the store. And unless you're paying $500 to $1,000 for a set, which typically I'm not, the quality isn't anywhere close to what this company is selling for a couple of hundred dollars. They just make a little less profit. This company is Bowl and Branch, and they only sell online at bowlandbranch.com. No, that's spelled BOLLANDBRANCH.com. And so you can't buy their sheets in the stores. That's the way that they keep the prices low and free of markups. They are so confident that you'll love Bowl and Branch sheets that you can try them risk-free for 30 nights, which is quite the offer. It gets even better if you order right now. They'll give you $50 off a set of sheets plus free shipping. If there's any phrase that I like more than free shipping, I don't know what it is. Just go to bowlandbranch.com and use the promo code XX. That's DOUBLEX. That's right. Get $50 toward a sheet set by going right now to bowlandbranch.com and use the promo code XX.
All right, our second topic. Last week, the Center for Medical Action, an anti-abortion organization, released a video shot in July 2014 that showed a doctor from Planned Parenthood over a luncheon discussing what parts of an aborted fetus might sell the best on the research market. So Planned Parenthood evidently sells the fetal remains for a cost of $30 to $100, which just about covers the cost of the procedure itself. It's an opt-in procedure, but all that being said, the internet, particularly the conservative internet and cable news, was not happy. June, can you walk us through this controversy?
Yep. So this is a tape. The final video that went up on YouTube and went viral was an 8-minute heavily edited version of an undercover video captured by apparently two anti-abortion activists. And they posed as people who worked at a fetal tissue procurement company. So they were having essentially a business conversation with Dr. Deborah Nucatola, who is Planned Parenthood's Senior Director of Medical Services. And the video shows them, as you said, Noreen, sitting eating lunch, and they're discussing things that can seem, if you're not in that world, rather shocking, you know, fetal tissue capture. And there was discussion of taking particular care to do an abortion, quote, under ultrasound guidance so that it was possible to get organs intact. And the Dr. Nucatola used a phrase, I'm not going to crush that.
Right. Well, so this, I think, was where the controversy lies and the ethical dilemma, even if we do see one here, in that as an abortion provider, your care is supposed to be to the woman. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you're modifying the procedure to make the fetus saleable, that's possibly problematic.
Some critics, or I guess ethicists, mm-hmm. suggested that. Certainly there was one, I believe, was quoted in the New York Times. But one of the things that's important to note is that this was something that is perfectly legal. You know, this mm-hmm. is something typically that the woman is either requested or certainly opted into. It's not anything that's foisted on her in any way. So typically, if the doctors were behaving this way, it would be at the woman's request, is my understanding.
Yeah, and if you go, I went back and read part of the transcript, which is available online, which is, you can see how much they edited. Yeah. The doctor spoke at length about that and how moving some women found it. You know, they might have complicated feelings about their own abortion, but to know, okay, I can help Alzheimer's research or whatever mm-hmm. it is, that provided some solace to the woman, which I thought was interesting.
Yeah, I mean, seems like it's a useful research service that they're doing, you know, that I don't think Planned Parenthood obviously does not view this as a profit center. Yeah. This is not going to influence the number of abortions that Planned Parenthood performs. They're not going to be performing more abortions because they're going to make money from this service or something. I mean, that's all seems very silly to me. That said, I mean, I can understand why. Certainly if you're pro-life, maybe even if you're not pro-life, you know, this can seem like a callous way to talk about fetuses. And you know, obviously, if you believe that life begins at conception, this is like a horrifying way to talk about fetuses. If, like me, you're pro-choice, and I assume we are all here very pro-choice, it can still seem a little callous when they talk about a procedure and whether it's crunchy or not crunchy. Now, but I don't really blame Planned Parenthood officials for talking that way because, look, I know when journalists cover a gruesome event, there's gallows humor behind the scenes. The way you talk to each other can be nasty. I mean, I covered the Michael Jackson molestation trial. That is very serious stuff. That's about molesting a preteen boy. But if you listen to the way journalists talked about it in the media room, I mean, it was not very respectful. It was not, you know, it did not take into account the grave, you know, reasons we had been gathered there. And these people, these Planned Parenthood officials, they thought they were talking to medical researchers who are in the same world as them, and they didn't think they had to, like, every time they talked about this, sort of, like, explain their souls to them that, like, of course, this is, like, I understand the grave meaning of this and blah, blah, blah. They I mean, maybe that got edited out anyway. But, like, this is the way you talk among professionals when you've been doing something for years. And, like, calling fetuses specimens sounds, like, you know, not great to us. But that's, you know, I completely understand why they would talk that way.
Yeah, I'd be a little alarmed if they were having a moral quandary every time they stepped into their office.
Right.
You know, you want someone who, she sounded like she knew her stuff. And I think people were particularly hung up on the fact that she was, like, drinking wine over lunch. I mean, she was at lunch and someone was asking her questions. She was answering them in a professional manner. However, we are all inclined to be on Team Planned Parenthood.
Absolutely.
So one of, I think, the interesting things about this case is that there is another shoe that's going to drop. Planned Parenthood has told the media that they believe this is the beginning of an onslaught of undercover videos from inside Planned Parenthood from pro-life activists. And so what's interesting to me is, like, why is there so much power in getting behind the scenes of Planned Parenthood for, you know, groups that are trying to convince Congress to defund Planned Parenthood, which they don't even, federal money doesn't pay for abortions at Planned Parenthood. It pays for other stuff, but whatever. Anyway. So what is it about being behind the scenes that seems to be, is it just the idea that we will see more abortion providers talking in these, you know, flip-sounding terms about what is such a ethical dilemma? Or do we genuinely think there might be something that pro-choice people might be upset by?
I mean, I think the response to this shows why there's concern. I mean, for one thing that bugs me, again, as somebody who is pro-choice and who supports Planned Parenthood, is these people going in there, and apparently they have thousands of hours of video, which means that they have spent thousands, they've wasted thousands of hours of providers' time at a time when we know that there's such a shortage of places where you can get this kind of advice and where you can get abortions. And it just makes me so mad to think of all this wasted time, especially when, if you're working at Planned Parenthood, I'm sure you know very well that there are so many people who are trying to, you know, who would love to stop your work and, you know, are doing their best to sabotage you. And so, you know, just this idea of people doing these undercover, which is to say by deception taping, is just, it makes my blood boil.
But a lot of Americans are a lot more on the fence than you are, right?
Yeah.
Like, okay, so I'm pro-choice, but I, you know, I'm Catholic and I feel that it's a decision with great weight, right?
Absolutely, absolutely.
So I think I'm pretty inclined to, I don't know, I'm attuned to the ethical dilemmas, but I didn't see it here. But I think other people might see it here and get upset. And it is such a, like, it's an issue that so many people are on the fence for. Is this something that could tip sort of fence sitters?
Well, the only reason for them to have this fake, you know, to come in undercover like this is in order to get that callous tone, right? If they come in through the front door and say, hey, is this a service you do? I think Planned Parenthood would say, yes, we do this service. We recoup our transportation costs. This is, you know, what we charge. And you wouldn't have gotten that callous tone, but you would have gotten the same facts. All you gain by going in through the back door undercover like this is that callous tone, the way people talk behind closed doors, which is meant to be shocking and may or may not be shocking, depending on your view of the situation.
I do think it's important to remember that there was no actual sale, that they weren't actually a business, that they were all the time surely angling to get that kind of conversation going, and that who knows, you know, probably this medical services director would not be the person who would make a deal, so to speak. I mean, it's all part of the way that they were setting this up to, you know, it's a propaganda effort. And, you know, as we've seen, it has been very successful. We saw last week that, as you said, Noreen, no federal money does go to pay for abortions at Planned Parenthood. But the first footage came out the same week that Congress was going to vote on a bill to help raise money for breast cancer research. And, you know, the Republicans raised concerns about, because some of the money was going to the Komen Foundation, which makes breast cancer screening available to Planned Parenthood patients, which is a very small part of the Komen Foundation's work. But as a consequence, Komen was cut from the funding. So therefore, this video, directly or indirectly, allowed Republican lawmakers to cut funding for a different kind of women's health care that, you know, people who were going to go to those clinics will now not have. I mean, it seems, I mean, as even as I say it, it seems like a ridiculous conspiracy theory to say, you know, that these videos are being used to stop women from getting health care. And yet, it really does seem that that's what happens. And it seems absolutely crazy, and yet it's real world. Again, from my particular point of view, that's how it seems crazy to me, but I mean, it's shocking.
And there's this real concerted effort where they had shown the videos early to some of the politicians, it sounded like.
Yeah, I think that they might be used as a cudgel in the budget fight this fall. And this could prompt another government shutdown if all goes horribly awry.
And apparently we can look forward to weeks and weeks and weeks more of these releases because they've taped thousands of hours that they are going to now dole out over the course of the campaign season, probably.
Yeah. One thing I will say is that if you're at all interested, I think it is worth going and reading the whole transcript, which, to their credit, this organization has put the whole transcript on their website, and they have highlighted certain passages that they think you should pay particular attention to. But I think there are probably other passages, at least in my reading, that you might want to pay attention to. But it's just an interesting look into the way Planned Parenthood does operate.
Ultimately, I don't think this is going to change anyone's mind, though, right? This is just going to solidify forces on each side.
Yeah. Maybe. I mean, I don't know about the fence sitter, like the people who go back and forth and feel conflicted. I do think that there is sort of a bullying tact. Like, people don't like bullies, right? And so if you're someone who could go either way, I would suspect that you don't like the guy who's coming in and under cover of night and trying to tell you what to think. But who knows? Well, let's smoothly segue from that to our third topic. What exactly is the female gaze, and what does it like to land on? We've had a few different answers to those questions this summer. So personally, I've seen some evidence here and there, including Magic Mike XXL, which posited that women want a range of things, from men with a dream of being Reiki healers to men who just want to dance alone, to Genuine's pony while making artisanal furniture, to straight up strippers in the club. Then, on the other end of the spectrum, you've got the on-screen model of the nice guy, as seen recently by Bill Hader in Trainwreck and previously Chris O'Donnell in Bridesmaids, I think. Mm-hmm. Anyway, Allison Davis of The Cut described this kind of man who, by the way, was cast in both those cases by women. Women were calling the shots. Amy Schumer, Kristen Wiig, this is who they wanted to be their dreamboat. Allison Davis described it as the emotional bodyguard, a.k.a. the Duplass-level attractive guy who just, like, will take care of you. But the desirable thing about him is more his emotional stability than his sweet pecs or whatever.
And his 401k.
And his 401k, you know, his...
Good profession.
Yeah, he calls his mother on Sundays, just the whole thing. And then, third, there was a video that went viral on the nowness.com, which we'll link to on our show page, that essentially posits that the female gaze is actually not so much directed to men, but it's mostly directed towards other women. Specifically, women are obsessed with the way other women present themselves and what they wear. All of these things could be true. All of these things could be the female gaze. But why is it so easy to define the male gaze and it's so difficult to define the female gaze?
I think we need to hear from Seth Stevenson.
Yeah.
So in watching that short video, the Nanus video, so it was a woman with a camera sort of stalking other women and like following them on the sidewalk and trailing them and gazing at them. But there was nothing predatory about it, right? So that was the difference with to my male eye. It's the difference between the female gaze and the male gaze. So there was nothing predatory about what she was doing. She was just trying to be like truly appreciative of the women and the effort they put into their clothes and their jewelry, and was like, I see you. I see your effort. I see you like expressing yourself. I appreciate it. And it was not this like predatory, I'm going to own that or I want that kind of gaze.
I think that video was very generous. I think the female gaze on other women is not always that generous. Mm. I think that's a major component of it.
Do you remember that movie 13 and it would have those, I think it's Amy Heckerling, I'll just double check this, and it would have 13-year-old girls looking at each other and they would stop and they would sort of do these like little jump cuts between like bracelets and earrings and necklaces where the girls were like looking at and appraising what the other girls were doing as a status ranking thing, and it was like very judgy.
Yeah, I think teenagers in particular are so obsessed with they're figuring out their own identity that they're looking to other people. But I do think like always women, I think you do get more generous as you get older, but women are sort of sizing up what other people are doing.
Oh. But don't you find, I mean, I'm sure that's right, and I'm sure that there was, like, generous is a nice term to use, but like almost a corrective feature that video was doing, you know, that you can see that sometimes the women weren't comfortable being looked at, and then they realized, oh, they were being looked at generously. Mm-hmm. So it was a little, special somehow. But how do you feel when you get a compliment from a woman? Like a heterosexual woman, it's not a come on in anywhere. There's no doubt about that. But I imagine that having your style complimented by another woman who perhaps, you know, goes through similar attempts to make a look work, that, you know, doesn't that...
It's so nice. Yeah. It's so nice. I had, in my early 20s, a friend said, I just tell everyone when I think they look pretty. And she always did. And it's just the nicest thing. And right. I've tried to, like, take some of that. But it's really, like, it feels different than a compliment from a man. First of all, because you sort of trust the women more.
Right, right.
Just, like, on a sheer taste level.
Uh-huh.
I don't know. It's a pleasant thing.
Uh-huh. It's interesting, though, to go back to the dudes. You know, what was the emotional bodyguard? Because, you know, I think we've all seen Magic Mike XXL recently. And there is another kind of guy. Like, it is very much, there's absolutely no predatoriness. There's, like, they're the anti-predators. They're, you know, building up women's self-esteem. You know, they're guys who have amazing bodies. You know, they must spend as much time waxing as, you know, any woman, and a lot more time, you know, building up those amazing pecs. But all they wanted to do was make women feel good. They were selfless.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was just as unrealistic as, well, as anything, really.
Yeah. I mean, none of these movies, and maybe I'll even add in 50 Shades of Grey, which I don't know if you guys have seen. Can't recommend that one as highly as I recommend Magic Mike XXL, but it's an interesting document. Also kind of funny.
Uh-huh.
But I'll add that in. I mean, none of these movies just let you look at a guy and say, well, he's a hot asshole, but I am enjoying looking at. They all have to have this, like, emotional backstory, and he makes you feel good, and so you can feel okay about enjoying watching him dance to Pony. Like, why can't women just in an uncomplicated way be like, you know what I'd like to do? Watch Channing Tatum alone in his, like, woodshed with his boombox doing a highly choreographed routine. That's what I'd like.
Well, so I rewatched both the first Magic Mike, and then I watched the second Magic Mike. By the way, I saw the second Magic Mike yesterday at 11 a.m. at a movie theater in Brooklyn. The only other people in the theater were single black ladies. That was the only, and then me.
You know, I went to see it at 2:30 in Brooklyn, and the only other people in the cinema was a silent white woman and this couple, I don't know what their ethnic background was, who were making so much noise, and also I believe lit up and had a cigarette during. So I don't
Wait,
know.
Really?
I don't know what had brought on the cigarette. It was not a highly policed.
Were they at least vaping?
Theater.
No.
No.
Well, okay. So the difference between that I noticed between the first Magic Mike and the second Magic Mike, in the first one, all the other male strippers, they really have no backstory whatsoever. They're just muscles. They're just pecs. And the story is really told from the perspective of Magic Mike and the kid, who are like these male strippers, and they maybe have some insecurity about the fact that they work as male strippers. They're trying to get out of it, or like they're trying to, you know, they get in a fight at one point with some frat guys, and it's like all from their perspective. The second movie, it is truly from the perspective of the female audience. You can feel it. Like,
yeah.
It's just
fan fiction.
It's just a romp. Yeah. And they're just like, and when the guys hang out, like in the first movie, they take ecstasy and then they're trying to like have sex with women. In the second movie, they just take ecstasy and hang out together. And they're like, I know we're rolling face right now, but I love you guys. And it's just
the most unrealistic drug use scene ever.
It's just like, it's just goofy bonding, but they all have these backstories. It's like a painter or he wants to make yogurt. So, like,
oh, right. I forgot about the yogurt. It's frozen yogurt.
Yeah. It's totally different. But I have lots of female friends who've gone to this movie on like a sort of like sacred hodge with like other women, like where they go together. And one of my friends told me that she was like high-fiving women she didn't even know in the theater. And here's the thing. So I think, and she was like, oh, when women go to strip clubs to do this, it's much more campy and silly. It's not like power and sex when men go to strip clubs. And so I had this thought that, like, it's almost the women are watching each other when they're at these strip club performances. Like, they're almost enjoying each other's enjoyment more than it's like.
Yeah, I don't know. I haven't personally been to a male strip club or any strip club, actually. But it is, I'm positive for the word camp, right? Because camp has a certain sensibility that Brian Lauder has
Indeed.
So brilliantly defined in Slate. And I'm not sure it's quite camp because it is. And Wesley Morris, actually, in his very smart review on Grantland, talked about the fact that this isn't quite camp because it's not from a gay male perspective. It's from a female perspective. So what do we call this? Can we come up with a word to call, like, whatever this phenomenon is, maybe not on air. We can all struggle privately with that.
Even like that final big dance scene with Amber Heard, it was less like sex than like an amusement park ride. Like
right.
He's like throwing all over the place. She's giggling and laughing, but it's not really sexy. It's not really sensuous.
That was really interesting to me because all the way through, like they're very careful to establish all times when the dancers interact with women who are, for the most part, strangers to them. That was a slight exception at the end. That there's consent. Like that's always very clear. They take great pains with that. And then after that, there's often this feeling of pushing boundaries. You know, like there's something even that Jada Pinkett Smith plays. I don't know what you call it. She's almost like the madam of this private. It's not a sex club because it doesn't seem like they have sex, but it's a private club.
It's an upscale strip club.
Yeah, I guess it is, right.
For
it's
women.
A, it's a private
for queens,
strip club
for queens.
Queens. Right, for queens, which again is a very loaded word. And they essentially, well, there's a variety of things that can be done to them. They can either have Donald Glover, you know, boost their self-esteem.
Post-divorce.
Right, post-divorce and make them feel hot and talk about all the things they like. I mean, I don't know, that did not seem particularly hot to me, although I love Donald Glover, but like that was just a weird song.
Yeah, I felt like he could have been so much better yeah. at what he was doing.
And
like, they had
like,
time to rehearse
oh,
that.
Oh my God, that was amazing. Like, really, was it? Because I think I could have done that.
I mean, he's cute. He's so you're going to give him some credit.
He's super cute. But then often in the dancing, there was this feeling of like they were pushing where women would go. Like they would, you know, twist them upside down, throw them in the air and then bring them back, you know, an inch from their crotch. Or they would twist them around or pick them up and then have their face in their crotch. I mean, I don't even know. There was a lot of, it was amazing that there was no touching almost. It was a very elaborate and very controlled lap dance. But there was a slightly thuggy element.
Yeah.
That was being played on, I think.
Which was probably part of the whole fantasy. Also,
right, exactly.
I think there was a lot of simulated cunnilingus, which I think
right.
also speaks to possibly the female fantasy element here. I mean,
right.
just what a document this movie
exactly.
is. What an amazing document.
I thought it subverted a lot of stuff in really fun ways. Because we can imagine a movie with a group of plucky female strippers on a road trip, and they deal with a series of male power figures who, like, lift up their shirts and assess them, which is what Elizabeth Banks does
right.
to Channing Tatum. She, like, lifts up his shirt to make sure his abs are still intact. He's like, he's chattel. It's amazing. And, you know, and it's incredible. And like, there's all, you know, you can imagine these women dealing with like healing these post-divorce older men who need mm-hmm. help. It would just be a very different mm-hmm. feeling than this movie.
Yeah.
You know, I have to say, I didn't really like the movie.
Oh,
it did nothing for me. I know. And I feel bad saying it because every single person I've spoken to loved it. And I just, the dancing didn't seem all that good to me. Like, obviously, Channing Tatum can dance. That was stipulated. We're not going to have any arguments there. But the others really couldn't.
Come on. What about the guy he's the dance off with at the end? That guy could dance.
Yeah, he could dance. But we didn't even know his name. Like, he was just there to be a guy, specifically a black guy, because there was a lot of fan service in this movie, who could also dance with Channing Tatum. But we didn't really see much of him. Didn't know his name, hardly. The guys on the road trip, they were just bodies. They couldn't dance, really.
But so why are we, like, why do we have to make these guys have a backstory? And why are we more comfortable with the Bill Haters of the world being our male leads than with the, I don't know.
Who would be the opposite? Like Matthew McConaughey?
He's too weird. He's too interesting and weird. It's like the you know, like the Taylor Kitsch of the world would, you know, which I think he was. I mean, I don't know if he's been in rom-coms, but he has really tanked as a male lead, interestingly.
Yeah. Now he's being so weird on True Detective.
Is it just that we don't, basically my question is, are women still forcing themselves to try to like the nice guy, or is this genuinely what the female fantasy is?
I have female friends who got upset when Chris Pratt lost weight and got abs, and they were like, I liked him a lot better when he had the dad bod.
Me
I liked
too.
Him better. Well, dig into that, Noreen.
He just seems so nice. I don't know. Like, you could hang out. I don't know.
Well, even Channing Tatum, who clearly has an amazing body, like, the fact that, you know, there's an equivalent of, I guess, a broad equivalent of the manic pixie dream girl, and it's like, it's the thuggy, dancey, sweetheart dude. Like, he's like, he there obviously is a kind, you know, he was a stripper, he takes drugs, he's not, you know, there, you wouldn't reveal his full biography to your grandma. At the same time, you know, he will flirt with you safely, and even if you're going through a period where you're into women, as his sort of, like, whatever...
Semi-love interest.
Semi-love interest in this movie is, he'll just try and make you feel good. Like, I just want to make you
smile. He's very other-directed. Very selfless. So, but isn't... So the old paradigm for, like, the male lead was the rough exterior, the Heathcliff, the Mr. Darcy, yes. Who's, like, very tough to... He's, like, rough, and you can't get to know him, and he's rude. But then you know that underneath it all, there's, like, a softness that you're going to find and bring out. But now, it's, like, it's right there on the surface. These guys are just sweet, nice, lovable guys right at the start, and you never really find... You never reach that, like... You never find that unreachable, distant act that, you know, that used to be there.
I also think, I've just been thinking about Chris Pratt for the last 2 minutes privately. And I think...
He went to a faraway place.
He went to a happy place. Uh-huh.
And I think that there is something about male vanity that women definitely find off-putting. And part of it is, people might disagree with me here, but I think in some way women enjoy the male gaze. And if the, like, objectification in the relationship is reversed and, like, the dude is the vain one, the dude is the peacock, mm-hmm. there's something that is troubling to women about that. They find it, many women, I think, find it just a little, like, what's he doing here? What's he doing?
But isn't that's the whole premise of Magic Mike XXL, is that the men are on display. In every situation, the male is making himself vulnerable, putting himself on display. I'm the object for everyone to watch here. It's not you. You're just going to have a good time, but I'm here for everyone to take in. So are those guys attractive, or is it, like, a silly, fun thing and, like, ooh, I like those abs? I mean...
I haven't fully unpacked all of the cultural commentary of Magic Mike XXL, but like I said, it is a document. There's something going on in that movie, but I think it does flip the script in an interesting way.
Clearly there's something wrong with me that this movie did not send me into paroxysms, but it was weird to me every time there's...
Well, maybe this is our answer, that you are not into men. And...
Right. However, that was the amazing thing about this movie, though, that they were trying to make everybody happy because they did throw in a couple of, like, and here's something for the lesbians.
What was
Well, so, you know, there's the talk about Amber Heard going through a phase with her, but that's just talk. But then there's that weird thing with Elizabeth Banks and Jada Pinkett Smith.
Oh, right. Yeah, yeah.
Which
was actually kind of hot, but, like, it was weird. I don't know why quite.
A couple of powerful ladies just female gazing each other.
And, you know, there's that whole thing where, in my experience, is true that, you know, female sex workers are often lesbians. And they even though there weren't many gay men, or, you know, all the guys, the team, they're all straight men, they did have that, you know, they went to the drag bar and they had their, you know, their moment of bonding with other male entertainers or nightlife entertainers. It was like, is there something for every last person in this film?
Well, it's funny.
Been workshopped, yes.
Yes.
Because if it had been a group of plucky female strippers, you know, I think we would be saying about the movie, oh, this is really about female friendship, right? Because the scenes with them bonding in between, be like, this is a movie about female friendship. But no one's saying this is a movie about male friendship.
I think some people have said
that. It's a little bit of bromance.
Okay, so I have one final question for this segment for both of you. Would you be uncomfortable if a woman wolf whistled at you on the street, or, like, catcalled you?
I would think it was a mistake.
That has happened to me once or twice in my life, and it did make
humble
me...
Humble brag. Brag.
Once or twice in my life? Don't explain my lived experience to me.
Okay.
You know what I mean?
All right.
That has happened to me. I specifically remember one time where a woman walking behind me said, nice ass, and it made me really uncomfortable. I felt like I was being looked at, and suddenly I was on stage. I was on display, and I didn't like being on display. I personally don't like being the center of attention in any situation,
but
actually.
But did you feel like it was a power reversal that she shouldn't, like, or it was just, no, it was just weird, some stranger?
I wasn't used to it. And, again, this only is like once or maybe twice in my life. And I wasn't about power. I just didn't, I felt uncomfortable being looked at. Suddenly I was self-conscious and like, oh, now I'm thinking about how I'm walking, right?
Yeah, welcome to being a woman, dude.
I know. Taste of, well, not my own medicine. I don't do that, but taste of other men's medicine.
Yeah.
What about you?
I think I would be flattered. It's never happened to me, but I think it would be an interesting change.
All right, good.
All right, so let's move on to our recommendations. But before we jump into that, one note. our summer movie club. We will be continuing. We had a lot of fun talking about the women, and it seemed like listeners enjoyed it too, judging from our inboxes. So we're going to, on the next episode, I believe, right? Next episode, we're going to talk about Thelma and Louise, which is the movie actually that I watched that set off this whole movie club. So I have a lot to say about it. You have not seen it, right?
No, I realized that I'd never seen it. Like, I feel at this point that nothing's going to surprise me because I've seen so many clips or I've even discussed it. But I realized the other week that, you know what? I don't think I've ever actually seen the whole film.
Well, get excited. It's awesome. So if you can, try and watch it. I'm sure it's available on, it may even be available on Netflix.
When I had a quick look, it was available in a whole bunch of places, I think.
Great. Okay. So recommendations. June, what have you got?
So I would like to recommend Lea Delaria's new album, House of David, which is... So Lea Delaria plays Big Boo on Orange is the New Black, but she has also a background as a jazz singer. And so House of David is an album that collects jazz versions of David Bowie songs. And they are magnificent. I actually saw her perform live, and she did just an amazing version of these David Bowie songs. She completely reinterprets many of them, and she has a fantastic voice. And if you have any sense of her and her personality, which is huge, it just kind of gives a new experience to these great songs. And one thing that did slightly make me sad, her version of Space Oddity has now supplanted Forrest Whitman's as the ultimate version. He likes to do that song in karaoke. Slate staffer Forrest Whitman.
Okay, I'll go next. So it's been a while since I recommended ladies singing country, so I'm going to go ahead and do that. So recently, Kacey Musgraves came out with a new album, which is not actually what I'm recommending. I was slightly disappointed in it. You can go check it out if you love the first one, as I did. But it got a lot of celebration in the press. She's, you know, the new country savior, but I thought it was like, okay. But one song that I discovered via a New York Times review of My Mistake by Cam, who's another country artist, and it's just like a great, like, barn burner of a song about a one-night stand, and it's really funny and great for a walk around the city. And then also there is a new Ashley Monroe album that's streaming right now on NPR First Listen called The Blade. And Ashley Monroe is sort of in the same camp as Miranda Lambert, and she's actually in, if you guys know the band Pistol Annies, which is like a super group of country ladies. Everyone's staring at me in the studio like, anyway, she on her last album had the great love song Give Me Weed Instead of Roses. And The Blade is more of the same, and it is worth listening to. Seth, what do you have?
So there's a terrific documentary streaming on Netflix right now. You can watch it for free if you have Netflix. It's called What Happened, Miss Simone, and it's about Nina Simone, the fantastic singer, and it's about her life story. And I knew her music and love her music. It's featured in Before Midnight, which is in an excellent way. It's that wonderful closing scene. They talk about Nina Simone a little bit there. That's when I first heard about her and started listening to her music. And I love all her songs, but I didn't really know her backstory, and it's fascinating. And she became really radicalized in the late 60s and the 70s. She started at her concerts urging people to become, you know, violent radicals, which hurt her box office a little bit. Places like Carnegie Hall maybe don't want you to go on stage and tell people to get guns. But it came from a heartfelt place. Her anger came from a real place. And her daughter is one of the people who talks about her and what she was like as a mom. Anyway, it's fascinating. If you like Nina Simone's music, you'll love it. Even if you don't like Nina Simone's music, this is a great way to discover her and get into her music, which I promise you, you'll appreciate.
I'm going to do that. I'm excited. And I listened to June's recommendation and I've started watching Unreal.
Oh, yeah.
So good.
Right?
I'm obsessed. Mm. Although Lifetime streaming app could be better. All right. That is the show for today. Thank you to our producer, Ann Hepperman, our managing producer, Joel Meyer, Andy Bowers, who's the executive producer of Slate Podcasts, and as always, our intern, Jossie Chazen-Tabor, who is all over Miley Cyrus's Instagram. the Double X Gabfest is part of the Panoply Network. Check out our entire roster of podcasts at itunes.com/panoply. You should visit our show page, which is slate.com/XX, our Facebook page, which is facebook.com/XXGabFest. Email us. We love getting listener email at XXGabFest@slate.com, and you can subscribe on iTunes. There's so much for you to do this week. And that's our show. We'll see you in 2 weeks with Thelma, Louise, and Hannah.
Ground control to Major Tom. Ground control to Major Tom. protein pills and put your helmet on.